KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Pacific Heights.
I'm from Milpitas,
Union City.
Mission Bay.
I do not know where I'm from.
Coming up with the legalization of cannabis, we might all be breathing in more pot smoke now. What does that mean for our lungs?
People think cannabis is fine because it's natural. I hear this a lot. I don't know what it means.
The health effects of secondhand smoke from marijuana. Then we'll hear about what the legalization of cannabis means for immigrants in California.
An estimated 11,000 people were deported for marijuana-related crimes between 2014 and 2016.
And El Cerrito's first poet laureate talks about making her father proud, despite his strict expectations.
Because he really had his hopes set on at least one of his five children becoming a doctor, and none of us did.
That and more coming up today on Cross Currents. Now that smoking cannabis is legal for adults in California, are we going to be breathing more secondhand pot smoke? Many cannabis users and even non-users don't think about the effects of that, partly because there's very little research being done on it. But anti-smoking campaigners say any smoke is bad for us, and we need to regulate cannabis smoke just like we regulate tobacco smoke. KALW's health reporter Marissa Ortega-Welch has the story.
Dr. Matthew Springer of UC San Francisco was enjoying a Paul McCartney concert a few years ago.
This guy went on for 3 hours.
When he had an epiphany that sent his career in a new direction.
People in front of me started lighting up, and then other people started lighting up. And for a few naive split seconds, I was thinking to myself, hey, they can't smoke in the AT&T Park. I'm sure that's not allowed. And then I realized that it was all marijuana.
There was a visible haze rising up over the audience.
Paul McCartney actually stopped between numbers and sniffed the air and said, there's something in the air, must be San Francisco.
Springer got to thinking, San Franciscans would never tolerate cigarette smoke like that anymore. Why were they okay with pot smoke?
And I was thinking to myself, well, I guess it's because they assume that unlike the tobacco smoke, that this stuff is not harmful.
Like any good scientist, he asked himself, is that really true? Or is secondhand smoke from cannabis bad for us?
It was right in my face, and I was thinking to myself, I can answer this question. There may be not be anyone else on the planet who can do that right now.
The thing is, Dr. Springer is one of the country's preeminent researchers on the health effects of secondhand tobacco smoke. He was already running smoke tests with cigarettes at his lab at UCSF. It wouldn't be hard to run the same tests on cannabis, too.
But I have to tell you, I spent the second half of the concert thinking to myself, can I do this? Can I do this? Should I do this? By the time I left that concert, I was resolved to at least try to make this happen.
Dr. Springer's lab at UCSF is not that high tech. There's a plexiglass chamber where he can put a cigarette or joint.
So if you look down here, you see this, what used to be a white plate, it is now a yellow plate because of all the gunk from the cigarette smoke that's accumulated on it. And then a sleeping rat, you know, they're asleep, they're anesthetized. The head is sticking through this gasket in the chamber, and so they're inhaling the smoke.
Maybe the most complicated part of Dr. Springer's work on cannabis is getting the pot. Because it's still federally illegal, he has to purchase specially approved government cannabis. And he can't test on humans, hence the rats. If you're wondering if the rats get stoned, he doesn't know. But his research has shown that the smoke, whether it's from a cigarette or a joint, affects the ability of the rat's arteries to grow and shrink. Over time, that causes damage that raises the risk of cardiovascular disease.
People think cannabis is fine because it's natural. I hear this a lot. I don't know what it means. I mean, it's okay, it doesn't have as many chemical additives.
Additives or not, inhaling smoke of any kind can be harmful.
People think about the bad health effects of tobacco, the first thing that pops into their mind is cancer.
Scientists are still debating whether cannabis can cause cancer. But Springer says the majority of deaths from smoking tobacco are actually from cardiovascular problems. So far, his research shows cannabis could have similar health effects.
People should think of this not as an anti-THC conclusion, but an anti-smoke conclusion.
So maybe everyone should just not smoke. Eat edibles or use vape pens or e-cigarettes. Springer is looking into the health effects of electronic smoking devices. They don't produce secondhand smoke, but still release chemicals in between puffs. None of this work is easy to do, since pot is still federally illegal, and that limits funding. Springer worries that in the meantime, people might come to the wrong conclusion that no news is good news.
We in the public health community have been telling them for decades to avoid inhaling secondhand smoke from tobacco. We have not been telling them to avoid inhaling secondhand smoke from marijuana, and that's not because it's not bad for you, it's because we just haven't known. The experiments haven't been done.
Anti-smoking campaigners say we can't afford to wait until the research is all done. This is Cynthia Hallett.
Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights was established back in 1976, before there was a lot of science about the health effects of secondhand smoke on the non-smoker.
Now her organization is taking on cannabis.
I'm seeing a parallel between this argument that, gee, we just don't have a lot of science, and so therefore let's wait and see. You know, the tobacco companies used to say the same thing about tobacco cigarettes. It's a natural plant. It's safe. Don't worry about it.
In California, you're prohibited from smoking cannabis anywhere you're not allowed to smoke tobacco. But Hallett is worried that the legalization of pot could erode those rules.
It starts on the premise of decriminalization, and then quickly it's the modification of, oh, but wait, now that it's legal, people need a place to use it, and sort of a chipping away at strong policies.
This is really a question of regulation. A lot of cannabis advocates want to see pot regulated like alcohol. They want cities to issue permits for specialized smoking lounges, similar to wine bars. But Hallett says smoke drifts and affects workers in a way that alcohol doesn't.
Actually, we heard similar arguments back in the day around smoke-free bars. It's like, don't worry about it. All of our employees smoke or they don't mind. And the reality was that wasn't necessarily the case.
The difference is, if I were to spill my beer on you in a bar, it wouldn't affect your long-term health. Driving under the influence is a whole other story. But if I smoke, it can affect the health of the person near me. Pot is more like tobacco in that respect. Hallett wants to see it regulated that way.
And so we have to go back to where we were in the early 70s and 80s. And just remember, it is still polite for you to say, would you mind not smoking around me? It's bothering me.
And what kind of reception would that get? I asked a few regular pot smokers at Magnolia, a cannabis dispensary in Oakland. And they said they try to be polite and courteous.
I always keep a conscious mind about that. I'd say it's always a balance.
I don't like smoking cigarettes outside. I appreciate when people move away from doors and stuff like that. I would expect the same for cannabis.
I've tried to be courteous, you know, just a common courtesy, like with anything. I have to be honest, this is the first time that I have heard secondhand smoke in reference to cannabis.
That was the case for most of the people I talked to at Magnolia. Even the dispensary's director of clinical services, Barbara Blazer, admits she thinks a lot about secondhand smoke from cigarettes, but not pot.
Both my parents died of lung cancer, and I will stop a stranger and say, you shouldn't be smoking. My dad died of that.
She recognizes that's kind of hypocritical.
Oh my, I gotta go examine those feelings, don't I?
Now that Prop 64 is in full effect, some of the state tax revenue from the sale of pot will be set aside for cannabis research. The State Occupational Safety and Health Board is also evaluating workplace hazards specific to the cannabis industry. With time, there will hopefully be answers so users and those around them can make informed decisions. In Oakland, I'm Marissa Ortega-Welch for Cross Currents.
Marissa is KALW's health reporter. Reach out to her at health@kalw.org. To find more stories about the legalization of marijuana, head to our website. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. There are still many messy discrepancies between state law and federal law regarding cannabis use. Last week, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions reversed three memos from the Obama administration that had instructed federal agents not to interfere with marijuana-friendly state laws. That's cause for concern for many Californians, and for the estimated 5 million immigrants living here who are not U.S. citizens, the stakes are often higher than for those who have citizenship. I'm joined by KALW's immigration reporter Nina Gensler-Debs to talk about what California's new cannabis law will mean for immigrants here in the Bay Area. Okay, so Nina, are the rules different for citizens than for immigrants?
Well, as we know, state law and federal laws don't always line up, particularly when it comes to something like marijuana. Immigration is regulated by federal law, and nationally it's a crime to possess, buy, or sell marijuana. And federal law, of course, trumps state law. So even if you're obeying California mandates, you can still get in trouble with federal authorities, like, for example, ICE.
So up until now, what has it meant when immigrants are caught, say, with possession of marijuana?
Well, basically, it would jeopardize your ability to stay in the United States, depending on what the conviction was. And marijuana convictions have had a huge impact on immigrant communities throughout the United States. According to the Marshall Project, an estimated 11,000 people were deported for marijuana-related crimes between 2014 and 2016. So immigrant advocates are really interested in looking at the changing relationship between immigration and drug enforcement.
Sure.
I talked to Angie Yunk. She's a supervising attorney with the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. And she just helped write a report trying to understand what Prop 64 could mean for immigrants here in California.
We have been looking at the impact of state laws and state policies on immigrants. And in particular, around this debate nationally of the medical use of marijuana and the legalization or decriminalization of certain crimes, how they can impact immigrants.
So Young sees a lot of cases where immigrants have been subject to pretty serious consequences for a marijuana conviction. She told me about one lawful permanent resident named Maria, who had a medical condition that she treated with a kind of marijuana ointment. So she was growing some plants.
And she ended up being arrested for a kind of cultivation of marijuana. And for that reason, she was prosecuted and she had an aggravated felony.
So let me interrupt here for a moment to explain. This is an example of something that is really complicated. There are some marijuana convictions that can be designated as something called an aggravated felony for non-citizens. It's kind of a misnomer because the crime doesn't actually have to be aggravated or even a felony. It could be a nonviolent misdemeanor, like, for example, growing marijuana plants for your own personal use. But if the conviction is listed as one of the possible aggravated felonies, it automatically is upgraded on your record. And that is pretty serious because aggravated felonies are deportable offenses. And once you have one on your record, you are permanently ineligible for a visa or a green card.
Even if you're just growing plants. So how would Prop 64 change that kind of situation?
Well, it's likely that it would prevent more cases like Maria's from happening. By the way, that case turned out okay for Maria. She was able to undo that conviction in court. Here's how Angie Yunk says it would work.
When you decriminalize something like marijuana and you never have a conviction, then there's no ability for the federal government to kick you out because you don't have a conviction for that. So that can protect a lot of people from getting that. And in many cases, too, it allows more lawful permanent residents to have an easier path to become citizens.
Okay, so I understand how Prop 64 can prevent people from being deported. I get that. But how can it help residents get citizenship?
Well, that's pretty simple. If you don't have a drug conviction on your record, then there's a much greater chance you're eligible for citizenship. And furthermore, let's say you got handed a conviction for a drug offense and you're serving time, or you've already served time and now it's on your record. Basically, Prop 64 allows people to go to court to overturn some of these past convictions.
And that can provide some relief for folks and for people currently in the process. You know, we're hoping that those cases can be pulled over so we can resolve them in the future so that they don't have to undo their cases because that takes a lot of effort.
Okay, so this sounds like the new landscape is pretty beneficial for immigrants. But is there a catch anywhere?
Not so much of a catch as much as the possibility of feeling maybe a false sense of security.
There are some provisions that basically allow some immigrants, if they admit to using a controlled substance under federal law, that they could use those admissions against them to not give them an immigration benefit or deny them entry in the country. So for some undocumented people, it could pose problems for them if they get interviewed by an immigration officer asking, have you ever used marijuana, even if they thought it was legal?
So that could also be true for lawful permanent residents, but that kind of situation would only happen probably if they were returning to the United States from another country and got stopped at the border. So immigration advocates and attorneys are advising non-citizens to never admit using marijuana to federal agents. Also, Young says that any immigrant who might consider working in the marijuana industry, so as a contract farm worker or in a dispensary, You should know that that kind of work can put you at a much higher risk in terms of your legal status.
That's a difficult situation here in California where it's legalized right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks very much, Nina.
No problem. Thanks, Ben.
That's KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs, who reports on immigration for us. Reach out to her at immigration@kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. Ma Shane Nguyen is El Cerrito's first poet laureate, and it's a job she's more than ready for. She's been writing and teaching and organizing cultural events in the Bay Area for more than 25 years. She came into KALW Studios and spoke with Jen Chien about her literary life and her newest collection of poems called Invisible Gifts.
Let's start with a reading of one of your poems, and if you could say just a little bit about it before you start.
Sure. This poem is also the title of my upcoming book, Invisible Gifts. And, well, a couple of years ago, my partner Tom and I were house-sitting for my sister's family in El Cerrito, and we were taking care of their beloved aged dog, and this poem is in memory of him. Invisible gifts. Choose the dog collar, feathers dangling from the bell. Mix beef bones and lemon peels. Watch fat curl into fire. Pick up cactus bloom, blow out pink flame. A box of ashes arrives at the door, one paw print, one leather collar. Missed repetitions. Round tin tags clinking against each other at 5 a.m. Dog dance, leaping up towards invisible gifts. Stroke his head on the hospital table. Watch technician sink needle behind black paw. One eye slowly rotating, partial eclipse. Blue shadow passing over pupil. The technician looks up. Faint whistle in the waiting room.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I want to say, first of all, it's a very moving poem for me. It's very beautiful. I lost a dog myself not that long ago.
I'm sorry.
So it's really lovely to hear that.
Thanks.
I did want to ask you, you did send over a few poems that you could read at today's interview. And they're all beautiful and all shot through somehow with a sense of loss, whether that's overt or more subtle. And I'm wondering if that was a conscious choice for you in terms of what you're working on right now or the things that you decided to send over.
I would say in particular the last 5 years of my life, I've, you know, had the loss of a sister as well as my father and Pepper, our family dog. And I guess it is a theme, you know, not that the book is entirely about death per se, but I would say that the idea of endings and beginnings is kind of a thread through the book.
It's a rich subject for writing, for sure. Tell me about how you first came to poetry. Was it as a young person?
I think it might have been in fifth grade because
here in the Bay Area?
No, actually, it was back east in Massachusetts. Uh-huh. At the end of the school year, the teacher I had had written a little poem and said, "One day you're going to be a poet," or something like that. I can't remember exactly what she wrote, and I remember that it had made such an impression on me. Anyways,
it resonated. I will be a poet.
Yeah.
I'm curious how your family then reacted to your choice. You are the daughter of Burmese immigrants, both doctors, if I understand correctly.
Yes. Yeah. I think that it took a long time, especially for my father, because he really had his hopes set on at least one of his children, five children, becoming a doctor, and none of us did. but I think he was concerned that I wasn't going to be able to make a living. So then he thought, well, then you should become a nurse. or you should, you know, go into business. And I was just like, oh, I don't want to do any of those things. So I kind of
went behind his back and just started taking all these, you know, Italian cinema and you know, experimental poetry. And I really got into punk rock and Los Angeles and, you know, joined a band, started a band with my friends and kind of did all the things that my dad probably didn't expect for me. But years later, you know, many years later, I think in his own way, he was proud of me for writing and my mom, too.
Was there something about California that,
you know, that
sort of unlocked that for you?
You know, no one's ever asked me that before. And that's such an interesting question because I remember I just always had this fantasy about moving to the Bay Area eventually because of, you know, its literary history. And I would, you know, come to the Bay Area often and visit and go to City Lights Books and read Poetry Flash. And finally, I was talking to a friend. We were on a trip and I brought up San Francisco again. And he said, Ma, you've talked about moving to the Bay Area one too many times. Time for you to move. So
just go already.
So yeah, exactly. So I've been here since the 90s.
And what kinds of things have you seen change since the 90s as a poet and as an artist?
My gosh. Well, I feel like I've seen the city change so much as far as like all the things that we know about, you know, artists leaving, artists, musicians, writers leaving. Just this week, two people I know in the literary community, you know, announced on Facebook that they were leaving because they couldn't afford to live here. So, I mean, of course, it's heartbreaking that it has become so expensive to live here. And so I worry, you know, how it's going to affect the arts. But then, you know, things give me hope, you know, small little galleries will open up. And, you know, there's still, you know, plenty of poetry events and music events going on almost every night of the week. So that gives me hope.
That was poet Ma Shane Nguyen speaking with KALW's Jen Chien. The interview was produced by Jackie Sojiko. You can catch Ma reading her poetry at Mercury 20 Gallery in Oakland on Saturday. For more details, go to KALW.org. Today's Cross Currents team includes Asala Sanipour, Raquel Maria Dillon, Zaina Nasser, Truk Nguyen, Andrew Stelzer, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are Gabe Graben and Jackie Sojiko. Our line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is brought to you by instrumentalist and hip-hop artist Johnny Cleveland. Catch his performance at Red Bay Coffee in Oakland's Fruitvale this Friday from 7 to 10 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.